Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to welcome you to our 2018 Annual Client Education Conference call. We are very glad to have you on the line with us again this year. And to get started, I will be introducing Jolene Searles. Jolene is a shareholder of the Anderson firm and also the managing partner of both our West Florida and our Tennessee markets. And she is going to kick us off today with an overview of 2018 tax changes. Jolene? Well, Jolene, we appear to be having some technical difficulty. We are not hearing you. Just in case your phone is muted, can you please press star 6 to unmute your phone?
Okay, my phone was muted.
Okay, Jolene.
I apologize for that.
Thank you.
All right. Sorry about that, everyone. So I wanted to kick this off with everybody's favorite topic of conversation, which is taxes. This year was actually a really big year for changes in the tax law. We had December 20th, the passing of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. That made some major changes to taxes as we have known them. I could spend probably the entire time allotted for this call and not fully be able to cover this, so I'm just going to take a few minutes to give you some of the highlights. The first big change that we saw was to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which was the mandate to have health insurance or pay a penalty. Another big change was to the tax brackets, to lower the tax rates and increase the income levels at which you hit those rates, with the top rate now stopping at 37% as opposed to the previous 39.6%. We saw big changes for the alternative minimum tax, with the exemption amounts increasing from $55,400 for single, $86,200 married, to $70,300 single, $109,400 married. But the big change with AMT is that the phase-out amounts don't start until $500,000 single and $1 million married, as opposed to the previously low amounts of $123,100 and $164,100 married. So we do see some really big changes for those of you who may have been hit with AMT in the past. This might be something that impacts you pretty dramatically. The personal exemptions of $4,150 were repealed, but the standard deduction was nearly doubled to $12,000 for an individual, $24,000 married. One of the big changes that are going to impact those of you in states with significant state taxes is the $10,000 limitation on the deduction for state and local taxes. So we'll remember in the past when we filed our annual federal tax return, we would deduct any amounts paid for state and local income taxes, property taxes, other taxes associated with that. Now we are only allowed to deduct up to 10,000 of those. So always a good reason to explore a change of residency to another state that might have better tax benefits, or talk to your CPA to see if there are ways that you can minimize those or other options you can take. You can also discuss with us. We are no longer allowed to deduct some of the miscellaneous itemized tax deductions, like the fees that we pay our CPAs to prepare our taxes, investment expenses, those types of things. For 2 years, 2017 and 2018, they changed the medical expense deduction, reducing the floor to 7.5% of the adjusted gross income before medical expenses can be deducted. Normally, you have to exceed 10%, so not sure why that was just for 2 years, but that's where we are with that one. We also saw a big change with mortgages, and the itemized deduction for interest paid on mortgages was changed to reduce the availability of that to mortgages up to $750,000, where it was previously $1 million. This will apply to mortgages on a primary and secondary residence, but it's no longer allowed for HELOCs. Any existing mortgages obtained prior to December 15th of last year, those would be grandfathered in. We saw some changes with 1031 exchanges. Those are now limited to real estate only. Our charitable deductions rules bumped up. So now we are allowed to have charitable deductions up to 60% of your AGI, where previously it was 50%. Corporations got a nice break where that corporate tax rate was lowered to a flat rate of 21%. We also saw for people with pass-through entities a big change. So LLCs, S-Corps, partnerships, those types of things, those people are allowed to deduct 20% of the income from those entities. However, this is subject to certain income thresholds and limitations based on the type of business that you have. So you definitely want to check with your CPA to see if this will apply to you or if there's anything that you need to do differently to make sure that it does apply to you. The child tax credit increased to $2,000 per child, and the phase out of that increased to $110,000 for single, $400,000 for married. There is also now a $500 credit for other qualifying dependents, such as parents or other family members. Big changes in divorce law, where for any divorce is finalized after 2018, alimony will no longer be deductible to the payor or taxable to the payee. So if you are in the process of getting divorced and that is all in place, or you've already been divorced and that settlement agreement is in place, then you're grandfathered in and the way you've been doing things will continue to be done that way. But going forward, any divorces finalized after the end of 2018, you're going to be subject to these rules. Finally, we, of course, have the big changes to estate planning. So we saw our annual exclusion amount bump up to $15,000 per person. So if you are married and you wanted to give $15,000 for each of you, that would be $30,000 to each person. The lifetime exemption doubled. Previously, it was that $5 million index for inflation that we'd kind of seen jump up every year, 5.45, 5.49. It doubled to $10 million index for inflation. So for 2018, the exemption is $11.18 million. So that's kind of a brief summary of those changes. What is important to keep in mind is that not all of these changes are permanent. So many of these changes will sunset at the end of 2025. So in 2026, we'll revert down to the prior rules in 2026. For example, that estate tax exemption will drop back down to that $5 million index for inflation. So the best advice that I can give everyone is to take the time, sit down with us, sit down with your CPAs, especially sit down with your CPA before the end of the year to see if there's anything that you need to be doing differently, any expenses you want to try to pay off before the end of the year, and explore with both of us different ways that you can take advantage of these benefits and plan for the changes. As we've seen in the past, when that political pendulum swings, there can be some pretty major changes. So we've got these in place right now, but for many of you, it may not be a bad idea to explore taking advantage of these while they exist. So next, I'll turn it over to Aaron Turner, our Director of Client Relations, to talk about the importance of making sure that your beneficiary designations are correct. Aaron?
Thanks, Jolene. And just to be sure, can you hear me okay?
Yes, yeah. Aaron. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Hi, and welcome, everybody. That was a big overview, or a small overview of a big change in the tax law. And as Jolene mentioned, I think it is important to really sit down with your CPA and us and go through a lot of those changes that would apply to you individually. So, but what I'm here to talk about today is something very specific on beneficiary designations, in particular retirement plans. And we classify retirement plans in a broad category, anything that is a tax-deferred type of plan, such as IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457s, and the like. And when we are looking at it from the estate planning perspective, it is definitely something that we want to take a close look at when we are doing a new estate plan or updating an existing estate plan to make sure those beneficiary designations match what the individual family wants to have done with those particular type of accounts. Because unlike your checking and savings account and your brokerage account, those retirement plans are not actually retitled into the trust, but we do update the beneficiary designation. So the other thing that goes hand in hand with this are the specialized types of IRA trusts that we have been doing for a number of years, and many of you have. We want to make sure that those beneficiary designations do list the IRA trust as the Benny. Typically, it is the surviving spouse, if it's a married couple, as the primary beneficiary, but then the contingent beneficiary, if that surviving spouse has also passed away, would be the IRA trust. And the reason we use the IRA trust is because we get the asset protection for the beneficiaries in addition to the stretch out. And when I say stretch out, what I mean is using the beneficiary's individual life expectancy for those RMD calculations, for the required minimum distribution calculations. So the IRA trust offers many, many benefits. I mentioned the stretch out. I briefly mentioned the asset protection that we get, and that's protection for the beneficiaries from in the event of a divorce. If we have a minor or incapacitated beneficiary, the IRA trust will make sure that they are not disqualified from any sort of government benefits that they would be eligible for. Lawsuit, creditor, bankruptcy protection to make sure those IRAs stay intact for the life of that beneficiary. They can have access to it if they need it, but we want to make sure that none of the bad people, none of the creditors, predators, divorcing spouses, would ever be able to get their fingers into those retirement plan assets. And that's a big issue, because if and when the money comes out of those IRAs, what happens? Well, unless it's a Roth, then we're going to get income tax on it. So the worst case scenario would be a taxable event where a beneficiary had to pull money out of their inherited IRA to pay a creditor or a divorcing spouse, and then turn around and have to pay the income tax on those distributions. So again, the importance of beneficiary designations, to update them, to review them, to make sure that they do mesh with your estate plan, and we have the right either trust or individuals named on those designations. So that's my two-minute spiel on beneficiary designations, and now I'll kick it back over to Jolene, who's going to talk about multi-generational planning.
Thanks so much, Aaron. That's a very, very important topic to cover, and you summed it up perfectly. So now I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the importance of multi-generational planning. So I want you all to imagine an organization worth millions of dollars where a CEO and the CFO refuse to share any financial information and guidance with the employees that are going to be taking over the business. In that case, it's very unlikely that that business would or even it would be able to continue after those executives step down. So we need to look at our family succession planning the same way. Studies have shown it's not high taxes and bad investment advice that's responsible for the intergenerational dissipation of wealth. It's the breakdown of trust and communication within the family, with about $40 trillion transferring to future generations by 2050. It's really important that we focus on ways to resolve this problem. One of the big issues with inheritance is that it's always been viewed as an end-of-life event. So we all, when we think about an estate planning and inheritance, we picture the family members all dressed in black sitting around the table in the attorney's office waiting for the will to be read. Well, unfortunately, by that point, it's too late to address any unresolved issues and problems that may have been created unintentionally by this plan. But when people include their children, their family members, their advisors, their beneficiaries in their plans, families are generally going to be much happier with the outcomes. The problem is that, unfortunately, death and money are not the most comfortable things to talk about with our loved ones, but these conversations do need to happen. Although about some statistics I want you to think about, although around 83% of people have an up-to-date estate plan, only 54% of them have discussed these plans with their kids, and only about 34% of them have informed their heirs how much wealth they have. 80% of parents have provided support to their adult children, but only 23% of these parents have set up trust funds for their kids. So we do want to think about that, because heirs that don't know the details of an inheritance ahead of time are twice as likely to have disagreements amongst themselves about the way that inheritance is distributed and about the way that plan is set up. Although only 34% of heirs will state that they wish their parents had done something differently, 72% say that they plan to do differently than their parents did. So just some good numbers to keep in mind. Today, our planning is it's more than just getting a will drawn up. It involves planning for retirement, asset protection planning, long-term care planning, planning for death and disability, planning for taxes, and planning for gifting. As people are living longer, we're seeing more of an increased desire to do giving while living. People want to set up college savings funds for their children and grandchildren, or give them that annual gifting amount, or help them with the purchase of a new home. So we're seeing a lot of that, but they still have that uncertainty about how much they're going to need to support themselves for the rest of their lives. So what can you do to ensure a smooth transition for yourself and your heirs? The first thing is to make sure that you have a good estate plan in place, that you keep your estate plan up to date. You want to make sure that you have a comprehensive financial plan, retirement plan, asset protection plan, long-term care plan. You want to have all those components to make sure that you've provided for every single aspect of your life. Consider how you might receive any inheritance from your parents or from other family members, how that will impact your estate. You might have your plan perfectly in place, but all of a sudden you inherit a large sum of money from your parents, and now that bumps you over the tax exemption. So making sure that you have those things covered. Keep good records of your assets. And either disclose to your children your assets or the whereabouts of those assets or where they can find that information in the event that something happens to you. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to sit down with your kids and say, okay, this is how much money I have. These are the four different banks that it's located in. Just tell them, I've got an estate plan in place. This is where you'll find my estate planning books. In those books, you'll see my most recent asset detail report. So many of you will remember when we set up your plans, we did that asset detail report listing out all of your assets, how they're titled, the approximate value at that time. That's something good that all of you can keep up to date or work with us to keep that updated. And again, if you send us copies, we'll keep those in our record so that if down the road something does happen and your family needs that information, we'll have the most recent updated information in our files as well. Where things are located. In your books, your estate planning books, you should have that location list. And I believe Angela also has a copy of that on our website where you can check off where you keep important things, paperwork, credit cards, checkbooks, tax returns, deeds to real estate. So where they would need to find that information about those specific assets. Look at how to minimize taxes for heirs, and that's estate taxes, inheritance taxes, income taxes, capital gains taxes. Consolidate your assets so that when somebody has to step in and take over for you, they're not running all over creation to try to figure out what you've got and where it is and dealing with all these different accounts. So the simpler that you can make it for those people, the better it will be. Make sure that your parents and your children have their planning in place so that can help make your planning more effective and it can save taxes at each generational level. Maybe have family meetings. Some of the most successful multi-generational plans, they have regular family meetings. And again, it doesn't mean that they necessarily have to share all the information, but it's a great way for parents to communicate things to their kids, give them advice, and pass on financial wisdom. Introduce key people in their plans. So I'd like you to meet my CPA, my financial advisor, my attorney, the person who I've named as my trustee to step in. So just let your kids know who those people are. Discuss responsibilities and duties upon the occurrence of certain events. So if you name one of your children, for example, as the trustee, let them know that they're named as trustee. So if something happens to you, everyone's not kind of looking around saying, well, what are we supposed to do now? Who's in charge? At least let that person know. If something happens to you, call the Anderson firm and they'll tell you what you need to do. So again, you don't need to tell them everything. I understand people like to keep things private, but you need to give them enough information that they'll know what to do or where to turn. Look at any potential unresolved issues, things that people might fight about. some of the biggest things we see people fighting about are those sentimental things, those personal objects, family heirlooms, jewelry. So if you have things that you think people might fight over, maybe go ahead and specifically allocate those up front. So identify who's going to get what asset. Do you have a business that somebody will need to take over and continue running? Who's going to do that? Or how is that going to get wrapped up? What are the intentions for the disposition of remains? Do you want to be buried? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want your body turned into a tree or a coral reef or a diamond necklace? So we see a number of different options out there. Identify what you want to have happen. And then again, work with your kids to make sure that they've got things in place so that if something happens to them and they need you to step in, if they're unable to make decisions, that they can do so. So again, you don't need to give your beneficiaries and the people involved all of the information about your assets and your estate, but give them enough information that they'll know that they are responsible for doing something and that they'll know kind of where to turn. All families govern themselves and reach decisions. The key difference for families whose wealth lasts for generations is that they do it by design. So next, I would like to turn it over to Will Anderson to discuss the increased use of trust protectors and how they really are the superheroes of the estate planning world. Will?
Right. Thank you, Jolene. Can everyone hear me? I know that people generally like to have a mute button on me, but how about now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you all again for coming. And so I do want to talk about trust protectors. And most, if not all, of the people who are on this call that have done planning with us probably have these provisions in their documents. But what are they? Well, they are really one of the most helpful tools in avoiding estate litigation that we can possibly draft in. You know, we can plan as much as we want to, but at the end of the day, we're not going to be here when our trustee is serving and we are trying to make sure that things are going right. So who does that? Who is going to make sure that things happen the way you want them to happen? And so if we have nothing, then no one is going to do that. We can hope that we've picked the right trustee, but I'm a big fan of checks and balances. I'd say that on the three or four litigation cases that we have against trustees right now, if those documents had trust protector provisions in them, those cases would not be happening. As Jolene said, the trust protector steps in. They're like the superhero of estate planning or the trust police. So when a beneficiary is having a problem with a trustee, if we don't have these provisions, then they have to sue the trustee in order to fix it. The trustee can use the trust assets to defend themselves. Well, if the trustee is not doing what they're supposed to do, that can be a very expensive proposition. Instead, the beneficiary can pick up the phone and call the trust police or the trust protector and say, excuse me, trust protector, my trustee's not doing what they're supposed to do. They haven't paid my tuition, and they said that they're not going to. Well, instead of having to sue the trustee, the trust protector can call the trustee and say, Mr. Trustee, either shape up or ship out. Do what you're supposed to do, or I'm going to remove and replace you with somebody who will. That way, in the span of a day and little to no expense, we have accomplished what it would otherwise take potentially months, years of court proceeding to accomplish. It could potentially cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's a really important provision, and we serve in that capacity at no charge. And people say, well, I don't want you to be looking over my trustee's shoulders. And I promise you that we are not looking over the trustee's shoulders. We don't have time to do that on the thousands of people we have. But we are a resource if something goes wrong when the beneficiary finds that out. Now, another good reason to have a trust protector is if there are changes in state law. You know, up here in New York, we've got some crazy laws of our own. And let's say that New York passes a crazy law that would go completely against your intent. Well, if that happens, then the trust protector can say, stop, we're not going to use New York law anymore because that would go against the client's intent. Instead, we're going to use New Jersey law or Pennsylvania law or some other law that would be in line with what you want. And so anytime we see a trust document, we need to make sure that we have these trust protector provisions in there. They save countless hours of worry and money, and they make sure that things happen like you want them to. So that being said, I'm going to go ahead and toss it back over to Aaron, and he's going to give us a little bit about planning for others. Aaron?
Hey, well, thanks. This is a brief part of this conference call, but I think it's an important one because we are seeing in today's society more and more unique family situations. It's no longer the Ward and June Cleaver type of household. We are seeing many more Brady Bunches, which would be a blended family. We are seeing single family or a single parent type situations, grandparents serving as that parent role. So when we encounter these types of unique family dynamics, and I would not go too far out on a limb here to say every family situation is unique, it is important to understand that these types of situations require a more attentive eye. There are different types of planning that goes with each different type of scenario. Some of it's tax law related, as husband and wife, as Jolene mentioned earlier, do get certain annual exclusions, and we can use both of them, whereas if it's a single parent situation, then we're only going to get one of those tax exemptions. So making sure that we have a full and frank discussion on the specifics of the family dynamics, if you will, is important to draft a proper estate plan. Not only for those individuals, but also for the children. Same-sex and unwed couples are becoming more prevalent. So if we have situations where families want to leave money generationally, but it doesn't look like there's going to be children or grandchildren down the line, then there needs to be a conversation on where those assets would go after those individuals have used it during their lives. So with that said, I'll just remind everybody, if there are specifics in your family dynamic, in your family situation that you want to discuss in private, we're here. Please give us a call anytime, and we can go through your options on those specific recommendations. And now I'm going to kick it back over to Jolene to talk about probate and estate settlement. Joe, are you there? Jolene. Well, it looks like we're having a little more technical difficulties with Joe.
It looks like she's about to dial in. She dropped off, so she should be coming in any minute.
Will, do you want to jump in and do your piece, and then when Jolene comes back on the line, we can kick it back to her?
Sure, that sounds great. While Jolene's getting her technical issues sorted out, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of updating estate plans. I have a lot of clients that they say, once we sign the documents, so I'm done now, right? And the answer is, I guess that's up to you. I'd say think about where your life was 10 years ago. Is it in the exact same place? Would you have the same exact people making the same decisions for you, whether it's your healthcare decisions, your financial decisions, if you're incapacitated, are your beneficiaries in the same place? I'd say 9 times out of 10, the answer is heck no. So this is an ongoing process, and it's always important that we update our estate plans to match where our lives are now. One thing that we have to be conscious of is avoiding trying to future-proof our estate plans. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. And, buddy, I'd be a rich man if I did. But until that happens, then we have to plan for exactly what the situation is today. So we have to have an ongoing conversation based on what your life situation is at the time. You know, we don't need for clients to become experts and when it's right to change a trust. We say, look, just give me a call. You know, whenever you have a big life event or you're not sure, give me a call. Let's see if this is something that we can accomplish with a simple amendment. Heck, maybe we don't have to do anything at all. But it's very important to keep those plans updated to our current life situations so that we don't have unintended consequences. The last part of this is talking about our asset detail reports, and we touched on those a moment ago. Those are the asset lists that we take at every meeting, and we need to keep those updated as well, because those act as one. They are our homework list, making sure that we get all of our assets retitled. It's a very important part of the process. Make sure that our plans work as they're supposed to. But we also want to be sure that they stay relatively updated so that we make sure that we're not missing any assets in our trusts. And the second thing that they are for is they're for your trustee. When you go to sit on your cloud or you're disabled, they're not digging through your mail trying to figure out where all the accounts are. We've done the footwork for them while you were still here. They know here's where the accounts were as of this date, and this is roughly what was in them. So it's an important part that we need to update anytime we make changes. If you haven't made changes to your documents in the last 5-10 years, it might be worth giving us a call. Well, let's talk about it and see if we are in the exact same place that we were 5-10 years ago. If that's the case, then great. But if not, let's do something about it. All that being said, Jolene, are you squared away?
I am. The phone had kicked me off, and by the time I dialed back in, you had already solved the problem. So thanks so much for stepping in, Will, and for summing that up, which actually segues perfectly into my next topic, which is talking about estate settlement and probate. So people ask us all the time what's supposed to happen after they pass away. Why is it so important to set up a trust as opposed to having just a will or not having any plan and just relying on, you know, the way that the estate law says your assets will pass? So one of the big reasons is that a trust keeps things from going through probate. So we want to remember that probate happens anytime we pass away with assets titled in our individual names. So what's the big deal with probate? Why do people hate it so much? Well, for anyone that's ever been through a probate, it's a pretty easy question to answer. So first of all, it's time consuming. Your average probate will take between 6 to 18 months, but we have probably all known probates that have been going on for several years. I've been involved with probates that have lasted for over a decade for a number of different reasons. So the shorter we can keep that time by keeping things out of probate, the better. Second of all, probate is expensive. The national average cost for an estate going through probate is 4-7%. So you can assume that you're going to be spending roughly 5% of the estate assets probating it. And that's a combination of administrative fees, court costs, attorney's fees, CPA fees. So it's a number of fees, but it is an expensive thing. And finally, my biggest issue with probate is the fact that everything, since everything is filed with the court, it's all public record. So you hear stories about all these crazy things famous people have done, like having their heads cryogenically frozen or leaving the bulk of their estate to their pets or not having a plan in place, and then we have unknown children come out of the woodwork. We see predators use this information to discover estates that don't have liquidity and that need to pay taxes or expenses, and then they go in and they make these lowball offers to buy estate assets, or predators taking advantage of young and vulnerable beneficiaries. So we can avoid probate by establishing a revocable living trust or other types of trusts and ensuring that all of our assets are titled in that trust. Simply by doing that, we'll keep your estate from having to go through probate. And then, of course, as Will mentioned, keeping that trust up to date. So updating it as key things happen in your life, whether it's your kids grow up and you want to give them more active role in it. Your assets change and increase, and we need to do additional planning. But it's important to know that setting up a trust, it's not a magical book. It doesn't mean that upon your death there are no steps to be taken. Your estate still needs to be settled. The main difference is that you're not doing things through a probate administration. So whether you have a trust, whether you have a will, the administration is going to involve identifying all of the assets, making sure that those final expenses and taxes are paid, and then distributing the assets to the beneficiaries in the way that you have set forth in your plan. You want to make sure that you have, again, responsible people named as trustees and administrators of your estate. And then you want to try to build into that plan as much protection and tax planning for your beneficiaries as possible. So again, remember that you don't need to be experts. The people that you name don't need to be experts in this. You just want to make sure that they understand what their roles are and where to turn. So I always advise people that the more information you can give your beneficiaries, the better. But if you tell them nothing else, let them know that you have an estate plan in place. This is where my documents are located, and that if something happens to me, whether it's my disability or whether it's my death, open those books to the front page. You're going to see the card for the Anderson firm. Call them and they'll be able to walk you through what next steps need to be taken. So with all that being said, I will turn it over to Christian Lazouk. Christian is our drafting and funding director, and he's going to talk to us about LLCs, why it's so important to keep them active, and some of the scams that we've seen out there lately and want to make sure that you all are protected from. So, Christian?
Thanks, Jolene. Florida has become a hotbed for scams because of the large number of elderly people living here. We are aware of a scam where companies are sending these notices to our clients that have recently filed their LLC in Florida. These notices appear to be from a governmental agency and are intended to scare you into believing that you are required to pay for a certificate of status or that you have to purchase a labor law poster. Don't be fooled by this. These are just scams. The certificate of status and poster are available online for free or for a nominal fee. We're also aware of similar scams involving deeds. So if you believe you have received such a notice, give us a call and we would be happy to look at it. I want to discuss the importance of keeping your LLC asset protected. This is very important. We are getting feedback from our clients that they can't keep up with the annual report filings, and in many cases, the LLCs are being dissolved. We're also aware that some of our clients are not keeping up with their quarterly or annual meeting minutes, which is required by the operating agreement. So in order to keep up an LLC's asset protection, you should follow certain business formalities. So you must file annual reports, keep quarterly or annual meeting minutes or resolutions. You want to open up a separate bank account in the name of the LLC. You might also want to consider a credit card in the name of the LLC. Finally, you want to keep your LLC's information updated with the Secretary of State. So if there's a change of address, you should notify the Secretary of State of this new address. So putting your fancy corporate book on the bookshelf and doing nothing more than letting it collect dust does nothing for your asset protection. So we have decided to come up with a LLC service to help our clients keep and maintain the asset protection of their LLC. We're now offering a new service where we file your annual reports and do your quarterly meeting minutes. The fee is $500 per year, which doesn't include filing fees or expenses. So if you're interested in this service, feel free to give us a call. The next topic that will be discussed is to how to avoid litigation in estate planning. With that, I'd like to turn this over to Josh Gornitsky. Josh is a litigation attorney with us, and he's admitted to practice in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Florida, and the federal courts in New York. Josh?
Thank you very much, Christian. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to talk about basically how to avoid litigation when you're planning your estate and going through trying to figure out the best way to protect yourselves. And obviously, litigation is not something anybody wants to happen. It's probably the worst case scenario for everyone. But when you're planning your estate and going through the process, it's important to kind of look forward and see all the possibilities. And the four main issues that arise in litigation context and estate planning are lack of formalities, which basically means that the will or trust documents are not drafted properly, lack of capacity, undue influence, and a breach of fiduciary duty. And I'll go through each one of those briefly so we can all kind of get some kind of general understanding of what each of those entails. Basically, the lack of formalities is kind of what it sounds like. Each state has a very strict requirements as to what needs to be in will documents, how they need to be signed, and who they need to be signed in front of. For example, in Florida, a will needs to be signed by the testator and witnessed and signed by two unrelated parties in the presence of everybody. In Florida, this is really important because in Florida, one mistake will invalidate the entire thing and you're going to have to go all the way back. So even if you have a 50-page document, make one mistake and it's all void. So in that vein, it's very important that you get an attorney to review your documents, because then everyone, you know, the attorneys are obviously paid to be aware of these things, and you won't really have that issue. The second and third issues kind of dovetail because they tend to overlap. They are lack of capacity and undue influence. Undue influence involves when the testator or the person making the trust is kind of compelled or coerced or manipulated into executing a will by someone who is very close. They have to be a very close relative or friend, into kind of changing the will or trust to benefit that person. The red flags regarding this are raised when a long-standing estate plan is radically changed in the favor of this person and to the detriment of the long-standing beneficiaries. Generally, that will result in litigation unless everybody is informed, and it would probably be helpful in that situation that all the beneficiaries sign some sort of release or something saying they are aware of this and they consent to it. That sort of acknowledgement generally could prevent any long-standing or very painful litigation in the future. The third issue is a lack of capacity, which is something that is unfortunately does raise some issues, where if a testator or maker of a trust ends up has some sort of mental deficiency, whether it could be, you know, whether it's just due to age or some other, you know, injury or something like that, whether it's a dementia or Alzheimer's in a lot of cases, if the testator or the maker of the trust executes a will or a trust document and they don't know what they're signing, or they don't have the capacity to know what they're signing, then that whole document is going to be void. And the best way to handle that, if there are early indications of senility, Alzheimer's, or even a form of bipolar psychosis, is to have the signing videotaped, have multiple witnesses who can attest to the competency of the person making the trust or the will. Finally, the last issue that generally is the issue, as Will touched on before, is a breach of fiduciary duty. And I'm not going to go into so much in depth because Will covered it so well, is that when a trustee or an executor to an estate doesn't do their job. Again, as Will said before, the Anderson firm has a longstanding practice a practice of establishing a trust protector to basically make sure that the litigation doesn't happen. So if the Anderson firm does your estate plan, it's generally not going to be an issue. But these breach of fiduciary duty issues tend to involve, as Will said, basically trustees not acting in the best interests of the testator or the maker of the trust. So these are basically the four main issues that arise at the outset of drafting your estate plan. They can be, your documents can be prepared in a way that can lessen the chances of you having to go to litigation. So in that vein, I'm going to turn this over to our Director of Client Operations, Angela Hooper. Angela.
Thank you, Josh. We are almost finished up for the day, but I want to address a comment that we want to avoid hearing, and that comment is, I didn't know your firm could do that. So let's review the Anderson firm's practice areas. Number one, and likely the area of law we are most known for, is estate planning. But what is estate planning? Whether your estate is a few $100,000 or if you're the lucky South Carolina lottery winner with a $1.5 billion estate, every client needs estate planning. But it's not cookie cutter, and we realize everybody is different and requires specialized attention to reach that person's needs and goals. However, with most people, the goal is to maintain control of what I own when I'm alive and well, take care of me and my loved ones if I'm disabled, when I'm gone, be sure my wealth goes to the people I want, when I want, and in the way I want, and accomplish all that with the least amount of stress and in a way that keeps my family together and doesn't divide them. So estate planning starts with a foundational plan. And an estate plan that works will include the revocable living trust, the pour over will, a durable power of attorney, a living will, health care surrogate, quit claim bill of sale, and the funding plan. And remember, funding a trust is just as important as creating the trust. Then in estate planning, we recover retirement planning, which Aaron talked about, and that deals with your personal retirement plan, such as IRAs and 401ks. Then we address tax planning. And depending on your specific situation, tax planning techniques can be employed to reduce income tax, gift tax, inheritance tax, and estate taxes. And there are over 60 different estate planning techniques that can be used to zero out estate taxes, no matter how big the estate is. The last thing we look at is advanced planning. And advanced planning is sort of like a la carte approach to solving a client's specific objectives or challenges. And some of the tools we use for advanced planning are the irrevocable life insurance trust, a spousal gifting trust, legacy trust, and special needs trust. And there are many others. And the next area of practice for the Anderson firm is estate settlement and probate. And today we discussed settlement versus probate, but what we didn't discuss is our skilled attorneys and highly experienced settlement and probate staff are here to walk your loved ones through this difficult process and provide a complete overview of the estate. They'll look at the taxes and debts that may be incurred, and they'll identify any portions of the estate that would require probate, and they'll hold the hands of your loved ones as they go through those processes. Our next area of practice is asset protection. So for some, putting an asset protection plan in place is advisable. And the goal there is to remove the economic incentive to be sued and also try and increase the ability to force an early settlement in the event a suit is filed. And we work with each client and their financial advisors and develop an asset protection plan that works to legally secure their assets and minimize taxes and transfer penalties. Our next area of practice is litigation. And as Josh discussed, litigation is a very specialized area of law, and that's why it's important to have a law firm that has experience in handling these matters. And our litigation attorneys are not only skilled in handling cases, but they draw on a thorough knowledge base of the very specific procedures surrounding these issues. They take each case through to completion, but they also realize that full-blown litigation can often be avoided if we work diligently to come to resolution. The next area that we practice in is real estate, and we possess the expertise of being able to draft and review any manner of contract relating to real estate, such as purchase and sale contracts, leases with purchase options, stock purchase agreements, joint venture agreements, mergers and acquisitions, business purchase agreements, and also deeds to get the funding completed in your revocable living trust or any other estate planning mechanism we've used that might require for us to retitle your personal property. So to summarize, the Anderson firm practices in estate planning, estate settlement and probate, asset protection, litigation, and real estate. And we hope that if you or your family or friends have needs that fall in these areas, you'll reach out to us or you'll direct them to reach out to us for a complimentary consultation. So now for conclusions, I'm going to turn this back over to Will.
Thanks, Angela. Thank you all for spending your time with us, and of course, please stay on to ask any questions that you might have. Just to wrap this up, our goal here is to provide what we call internally the ultimate client experience, and that just means we want this to be the best experience that you have ever had dealing with a law firm. If it's ever not, we want you to let us know so that we can make sure that it is. We do practice in all 50 states, so no matter where a client is, we're here to help, whatever their asset level is. We sometimes hear, we thought you only did work with X amount and above, and that's not the case. We have clients ranging from a couple hundred thousand to $1.2 billion. So there's no one in no situation that we can't help. And if someone else, another firm, has done planning that you want to have checked, we always review trusts and plans for free. If they're good, we'll tell you they're good. If they're deficient, we'll tell you how. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that every single one of our clients is taken care of. So if you ever want to talk to us, just bounce ideas, get a hold of us, as always, at 866-230-2206. And we really appreciate you joining the call today. And to end it, I'm going to turn it over to Rhonda.
Thanks, Will. Now, before we open the floor up for our question and answer session, I do want to remind everyone that we are recording this call, and the recording will be uploaded to our website for those individuals that weren't able to join us today. They can link in and listen at their convenience. But since it is being recorded, we would ask that you provide only your first name when asking questions. That way we're not publishing the full names of our clients when we post the recording up on the web. So having said that, we're now ready to open the floor up for questions. If you have a question that you would like to pose to any of our presenters, all you will need to do is press *6 on your phone. That will unmute you and allow you to pose your question. Again, that's *6 on the keypad of your phone, and then just go ahead and ask your question.
This is John.
Hi, John. Please go ahead with your question.
I actually have two. I forget which of you talked about retirement plans, and something he or she mentioned something called stretch out.
Hi, John. That was me. This is Aaron Turner.
And I don't know what that is.
Sure. So when we stretch out is a term of art, and what that means is when we have a retirement plan, we can only defer the income tax on that retirement plan for so long. And if I'm the originator, if I'm the one that created it, if I'm the original IRA contributor, then I get to wait until 70 and a half before I have to start taking money out of that retirement plan, right? So the IRS says you get to wait until 70 and a half, and then there's an RMD, required minimum distribution, that comes out every year based on your age.
I'm in that right now. So.
Okay, very good. But when I pass and I leave that retirement plan, that account to my spouse, they get to use, my spouse gets to use her life expectancy, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then when we're both gone and we leave it to our children, the stretch out comes into play when the kids, if we do it right, the kids get to use their individual life expectancies, children or grandchildren, what we would call non-spouse beneficiaries. So it could be children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, anybody that you wanted to, really. So the term stretch out means setting up the beneficiary designations in the proper way to ensure that the individuals that we're leaving those retirement accounts to get to use their life expectancy for those required minimum distributions. And one key point here is that when those RMDs come out for non-spouse beneficiaries, they don't get to wait until 70 and a half. They have to take those RMDs the year after they inherit it. But if I leave it to somebody who is much, much younger than I am, then those RMDs are going to be much, much smaller. So the younger the beneficiary, the smaller the RMD, which allows the stretch out to grow even longer.
Okay. So I understand what you said, but I have a further question then. If all my IRA assets go to my trusts, so,
yes.
So therefore, doesn't the RMD then go away because now they're in trusts?
That was my key point. If those beneficiary designations are drafted properly, and if we did them for you, then I can assure they are drafted properly because we
which you guys did.
Yes, sir. So because we drafted them in a way that allows the individual beneficiaries of your trust. So obviously, I'm not going to talk about your specific situation, but I'll use the example. If I've got three kids and I say my primary beneficiary is my spouse and then my contingent beneficiary after my spouse and I are gone is my trust, and those three children are the beneficiaries of the trust, using our beneficiary designation, each of those three kids is going to get a third, and a third of my IRA, and they're each going to use their individual life expectancy when the IRS calculates that RMD. So if I've got children that are younger significantly than my oldest child, then that younger child is going to get a longer stretch and not have to use the oldest child. So that was a long-winded answer to your question. That is, yes, if it's to your trust, the individuals will get that stretch out.
Okay. Yeah. How do they know that?
How does the children?
Yeah. How do my children know? I didn't know.
you're intelligent enough to ask that question, and that would be something that would be covered with those beneficiaries and the trustee after you've passed. And so, as Jolene mentioned in her estate settlement and probate portion, you know, these documents, they don't grow arms and legs and run around and do those types of things and have those types of conversations after a person passes away. There is a process that needs to be had, which is essentially a retitling and education process for the trustees and beneficiaries to make sure that all the good things that are available from doing this type of planning are capitalized on, they're made use of. So that's just one piece, you know, making sure the stretch out happens in the proper retitling in addition to the tax planning and asset and all that other stuff that we've gone over today. So if you got any more questions on this, John, I'm free to talk to you.
No, I don't, but I got a couple other questions.
John, why don't we do this just to give other folks a chance?
Yeah, go ahead.
If we can, we'll take your number and give you a call individually, and I can go through all the questions with you offline, specific on your individual situation. Does that sound good?
That's fine. Yeah. I mean, Jolene's my contact. But,
Okay. Well, she's more knowledgeable than I am, so just.
Yeah. So I mean, I'll just check back with her. I got some notes. So I'll just check back with her.
All right.
Yeah, just give me a call, John, and we'll sit and talk through everything.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thank you. Thanks for calling in.
Yep.
Joe here.
Hi, Joe.
This is more of an observation and perhaps a request to Jolene. Your review of the tax changes was very informative and, of course, extensive. It would be very helpful if a printed copy of the main points of the tax changes would be available either on your website or by our request with an email so that it could facilitate our discussions with our CPA.
Absolutely. And I believe Angela is in the process. We do a quarterly newsletter that we post on our website, and we do have a really good summary of all those changes in, I believe it's this month's newsletter. And so Angela should have that up on our website shortly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions?
Just as a reminder to everyone, if you do have questions, please press *6 on your phone to unmute it and go ahead and give us your first name and pose your question.
either we did a very good job of explaining it or we confuse people to where they don't know what questions
to ask. Put him to sleep.
Go ahead. I heard somebody start.
Yeah, hi. This is Charles in Florida.
Hi, Charles.
How's everybody? Thank you for the call. This may be more of a financial or financial planning observation or question than estate planning in a way. But I guess when you think about it indirectly and eventually possibly directly, it can affect one's estate planning. And where I'm going is this. One of the things we're experiencing here in Florida is the rising cost of long-term care insurance. And it puts individuals and families, or it can, in a predicament where when they did the original planning and determined, okay, we can't self-insure, we need protection in that area, and then as these premiums rise, And I can personally testify to this. I acquired a policy myself several years ago. I've never been on claim. I've had one 18% increase. I'll have another 25.6% increase in January if I keep the same policy.
Ouch.
And it will ultimately increase by 233.8%. From around $2,758 a year in premium to $6,448 a year in premium 3 years from now.
Good.
And I've never been on claim. So, and of course, we have options. You can either pay it, you can cancel it, you can cut it back and co-insure if you're able to do those sort of things. And I saw a family right here in Jacksonville over a period of years go through half of their net worth because they had no the husband had no long-term care insurance. So you're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't in some respects. And I'm sure y'all have seen all of this, but where I'm going, I guess, is I know y'all are not necessarily in a position to recommend carriers. Mine's with a major carrier, but it seems to be happening in a lot of places, and you think you've done your proper planning, and then this comes along, and either actuarially they've not computed or figured things accurately. Some companies are even getting out of the business because they can't afford it or losing money. And, you know, what's one to do? I mean, I don't know if there's a...
Charles, let me say this about that. If I can, I know, well, first off, I think you're correct that you're sort of six, one, half a dozen, the other. Based on the type of policy that's available is really going to determine, you know, what the future holds. It can have certainty or uncertainty. And I think as a general statement, you're going to pay more up front for certainty, but you know that that policy is going to be available. And so, you know, we're estate planning attorneys, but this is definitely something that dovetails into what we do every day. And working with financial advisors and insurance brokers and people who are much, much more knowledgeable in this field than we are, we know enough to be dangerous. And I think as a general statement and party line here at the firm, we're big fans of long-term care insurance if it's the right product, because it offers multiple things. It offers what I call asset protection. It's not protection from the claim of a creditor or divorcing spouse, but it's asset protection in terms of
spending down your own assets.
Exactly. Just as you mentioned with that family that run through half of their net worth taking care of themselves. But that's what the money is there for. So, you know, the other thing I find with long-term care insurance is, again, like with any type of planning, it adds some certainty, some sort of safety net there, because as the market does its gyrations, which we're seeing here the last week, as family individual needs and family needs sort of fluctuate. Nobody's got a crystal ball. We don't know exactly how much we're going to have or what the nature and the makeup of the assets in the estate are going to be. Long-term care insurance can solve a lot of those variables for us. But again, it all boils down to the type of product that's available. So I think that is a conversation that needs to be had. We're big proponents of it if I'm sitting at the table with a financial advisor and a client and the topic is broached. I say, absolutely look at it. If you've got the cash flow now, it would be something that would make sense from an estate planning perspective. You need to make sure it makes sense from a financial perspective, and that's done with the insurance broker and the financial advisor.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything you said. I just didn't know if there might be a website or are there any particular names of carriers y'all are aware that are in the business that one could reach out to get quotes to make
again,
to
just see. I don't know, and I can't make a firm recommendation to anyone in particular other than to tell folks to have that conversation with their financial advisor if they've not done so already, because it is such a changing environment. Long-term care insurance was very popular 8 or 10 years ago. Insurance carriers were offering all sorts of different policies. Then they went away. The carriers were getting burned on those things because of the cost of health care was going up so much. So they went away for a number of years, and now they're back. But there's, again, it's a changing environment. And I read somewhere that Warren Buffett, of all people, he's got a long-term care policy. And he said it just makes financial sense. And if I can think of anybody that self-fund their health care needs for the rest of their lives, it's that guy. So, again, it's not something that we can opine and make specific recommendations on, but it definitely is something they should have a conversation with their financial advisor about.
Yeah, maybe that's something that one of his own companies sells. He wants the radiation of the business to other people to realize that and give them business.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Charles. Again, if you have a question, please press *6 to unmute your phone and go ahead and pose your question.
Hi, this is Meryl. Good afternoon.
Hi, Meryl.
Hi. I've run across a couple attorneys and firms, especially in the Northeast, New York, New Jersey, that would recommend only creating a will instead of a revocable trust. And a lot of the times I'm hearing the reason is because probate's a lot easier up there than in Florida. Can you comment on that?
I would be happy to, Meryl. Thank you for posing that question. I almost made this its own section of the presentation today. And this is Will Anderson. I run all of our New York and Northeast operations. And so a lot of times people do hear this. And, if you die with an estate under $30,000, they're probably right. We can do what's called an expedited probate. And it's not too bad. But for anyone who's over that number, it is going to be at a minimum 8 months. And that's if everything on paper goes perfect. I've never seen one actually wrap in 8 months. Generally, we're looking at least a year. To give you an example, I've got one that we're in year three, and we're about to get access to some bank accounts. A lot of attorneys that say that, and I try to be as nice about this as I can, even though it does make my blood boil, they do what I call will mills. They like to do wills for clients because they will say, that's $1,200, you're good to go out the door. Well, they do that because they want to collect the probate fee on the other end. In New York, that's generally 5 to 8, if you Google it, 5 to 10% of the value of the estate. Now, that's fantastic for the attorney. That's not so good for the client. And so that's not how we do business. We want to make sure that we can wrap everything up quickly, efficiently, and cheaply for every single client. So that's why, if I was hard-pressed to do a will for a client and I was able to say my entire piece and they still said, I want a will, I suppose I would do it, but it would really be under protest because it's not going to be the best, the cheapest, any other good thing for the client. Does that answer your question?
It does, and I absolutely agree. There's a scenario where we had an attorney say that, well, it's a $30 million estate, most of it's investable assets, very quick to go through, I charge by the hour, and only one real estate property. And I said, it would only take me, you know, several hours. And so when you look at something like that where it's fairly simple, if their assets are all under one financial institution, multiple registrations, and one real estate property, I mean, how many hours would you estimate, which I know you obviously can't be exact, but how many hours do you think an attorney or a firm would bill for that?
And I really cannot answer that question because I there's just no way to know. I mean, when we get into the process, there's several meetings that would go into determining what would even be a fair charge. Now, I would warn, because you specified the Northeast, there are several states up here that have statutory fees that attorneys can charge, and they're percentages of the estate. So regardless of how much or how little work, this is how much that they can charge. One thing I can tell you is that you've got mandatory creditor waiting periods where, you know, we can file all the paperwork, and then we're sitting there twiddling our thumbs for months and until finally we can get things released. And at that point, even when we do get them released, we may have challenges, especially because you set a $30 million estate. One thing I'll note, when we use a will, it's a public document. You can go to the courthouse and you can pull the will of anyone who ever died with a will and see who got what. You can see amounts and in some cases addresses. If you've ever been named in somebody's will and you started getting junk mail that is offering to help you with the estate, well, guess where they got your address? They got it from the courthouse. And one of a joke that Jolene used to tell, but there's a big grain of truth in it, was when her parents would get on her for not being married, she'd say, well, don't worry about it. I'm just going to go to the courthouse, and I'm going to see who just got a big inheritance. Now, of course, she's joking, but it's scary because people can do that, and it opens you up to creditor claims, not just creditor, but to predator issues. And if you look at Prince, who just died, he had children and brothers and sisters and all this other stuff coming out of the woodwork. But when we use a trust, it's completely private process. No one is entitled to a copy of that document other than the people that are named in it. So I say all of that to say that when we have a will for that $30 million client, they're opening themselves up an incredible amount to creditor claims or to predator claims when they could be avoided simply by making a trust. So I know that that didn't answer your question like you wanted it to, but I hope that that was at least something.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And Will, one thing I'll add to that too is, you know, Merrill, with that estate, there are also other factors that will fall into how much time needs to be spent. So even if the lawyer is billing hourly, you want to look at things like, if it's set up in a will, does that will have 27 different beneficiaries? So even if it's just one account and one piece of real estate, do we have a number of beneficiaries? Are any of those beneficiaries minors? Are they out of the state or out of the country? Does the will create, you know, trust within the will, or are things going out right? So there are, as Will mentioned, there are a number of administrative things that could make this extend out and take longer and be more expensive, but also depending on how the plan is set up, there could be a number of things that can add additional time and cost to it.
Okay, great.
It's
thank
just penny
you.
Pennywise and pound foolish.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Merrill. Does anyone else have questions? Again, #6 to unmute your phone if you do.
Hello, this is John.
Yes, John.
I heard the term special needs trust, and I don't know if this dovetails into a situation that I'm concerned about is a beneficiary that has learning disabilities and is much younger than my trustees. Is there a way to have a vehicle that somehow can structure, you know, making sure his rent's paid or utilities are paid or things like that? Because my thinking is this beneficiary will outlive my trustee.
Absolutely, John. And so two things I want to touch on with that. One is if the beneficiary does have special needs, we want to make sure that we've got the right language in that trust where their trust will be treated as a special needs or supplemental needs trust so that if they're receiving any sort of benefit, that whatever they inherit isn't going to get, they're not going to get disqualified from those benefits. It's not going to cause problems. The second is making sure that, as you mentioned, you've got the right people in there to continue that trust. So obviously, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to name your trustee. I always recommend to people at the very end of the line, I don't care if you want to name seven different individuals, but I always like to have a corporate trustee at the end of the line. And that way you don't ever end up in a situation where you've got a special needs beneficiary who maybe doesn't have the wherewithal to kind of know where to go or what to do if their trustee were mm-hmm. to pass. So maybe we've got that corporate trustee named as a final backup. So if that existing individual trustee passes away, then that corporate trustee would step in there and be able to take care of that beneficiary. So that usually is going to be kind of my go-to way to end it. You can also have provisions in there where you have the trustees appoint successors, or if your trust has a trust protector, that trust protector oftentimes will be able to step in if there's no trustee named and the beneficiaries can't name a successor trustee, then the trust protector mm-hmm. can step in and name one. So there are a number of different possibilities, and if you want me to look or any of us to look at yours specifically, we'd be happy to look at that specific trust and kind of see how it's set up and what defaults you have in place and if we need to add anything or change anything.
Well, you guys did do the trust. However, at that time, you know, I just assumed, I just didn't bring it up or talk about it or just didn't, forgot about it. But the corporate trustee, is that something that the Anacert firm would be?
We generally do not serve as trustee, but uh-huh. there are a lot of different corporate trustees that we've worked with that we can okay. talk to you about, and we can give you some names. You know, some people just say, just give me a couple good recommendations, and I'll pick one out of a hat. Other people want to call and talk to the corporate trustees and get a better idea of how they would run things. There are some corporate trustees out there that really focus and excel in the special needs trust area. So we can definitely talk more about that.
Okay, and we will. Okay, great.
Great. Thank you, John.
Any other questions? Again, *6 to unmute your phone.
Going once, going twice. And please remember, you all or anybody that's still left on the call, please feel free to call us individually to schedule an appointment, either in person or over the phone to review specific situation, or if you leave the call and go on with your day. And remember, I forgot to ask that question. We're here. We're available. We don't charge hourly to go through those things with you. So whether it's now or later on, please feel free to give us a call and ask specific questions on your individual situation.
Okay. Thank you all
Thank
so
you,
much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining yeah. us. And if we don't speak to you between now and then, we will do this again next year. But as Aaron said, feel free to give us a call anytime you do have questions regarding your trust or any additional work that we might be able to be of assistance to you. Thank you, and have a very nice day.
Thank you.